This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guests are two members of Oscillatorial Binnage.
Hello.
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 That's Toby Clarkson and Daniel R. Wilson. And we started with the third member, which is Fari Bradley, on the piano.
Yes.
And the other member is Chris Weaver.
Yes.
Who is where?
Chris Weaver is at the British Library in the Sound Archive.
Why is he not here?
He's working. He can't get off work.
Okay. All right. So oscillatorial binnage. Where does that come from? Why is oscillating, trembling and shaking stuff that comes out of a bin?
That's perfect. Yeah. I can't think of any. Yeah. It's very self-explanatory. Title.
Yeah. And you are an improvising, what do I call you? Band? Piece?
Quartet.
Quartet. How long have you been together?
We were formed from the embers of a much older group called Piecing Cho. Piecing Cho was Sarah Washington, Knut Alferman, Moshi Honan, and Chris Weaver and me. Uh-huh. And we each bought our own circuits to the proceedings, homemade circuits. This was around 2001, 2002, 2003. And then one day we were given the opportunity, me and Chris, the kind of remnants of Piecing Cho, to perform a duo.
How do you spell Piecing Cho? What does that mean?
The letter P,
yeah.
Then the word sing,
okay.
And then Cho, C-H-O.
All right.
It was Knut's. I can't remember the origins of it. It's so long ago. Anyway, that was an electroacoustic circuit bending, hardware hacking, circuit making group, and we continued that ethos. And we were asked to me and Chris to perform at the South London Gallery as part of Pete Coffin's installation in a greenhouse, and we didn't know how to get there, and Toby was on the bus showing us how to get there, and on the spur of the moment we just said, come and join us. Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember it slightly differently, to be honest.
Let's hear your version, Toby.
As I remember it, we were actually... Do you remember me and Chris were living in Tyrwhitt Road?
Oh, yeah.
St John's, and then you came round... Because I remember we were listening to your radio show, brilliant radio show, which used to be on Resonance, called The Hellebore Show, and me and Chris Weaver used to listen to it religiously every week.
But Chris was engineering it as
Chris was engineering, so he knew you already, and we were big fans of your show. And then me and Chris kind of conspired together to meet you.
Oh.
And to get you round.
This is an entirely different aspect of the story. There's no buses, anything.
Anyway. I don't remember the bus. I mean, I remember we took a bus, but.
We were on the bus, and that's when I asked Toby, can you join us for the proceedings in the greenhouse?
Yeah, I remember it. Is that actually you came round, and then you guys all started jamming together, and I didn't have any history as a musician or anything like that. No, but then. Really? I remember it as before that. I had my video cameras because I was making films and stuff.
Yeah.
And then you guys showed me with electromagnetic coils how I could suggested I could use those with electronics.
Yeah,
I brought down
later,
my camera. Was that later?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I thought the greenhouse gig, I was playing all the aerosols. Do you remember?
Yeah. But the greenhouse was before we even settled on the name Oscillatorial Binage. We were just.
I remember that, but I don't. But I thought we'd jammed a bit together before, but maybe my memory.
So if Chris and Fari were here, we'd have two more different versions.
But most likely, we would have. Yes,
we'd have four versions.
Yeah. Or five, even.
And you all disagree.
That's like how we play together. We all kind of disagree.
Do you? Is that right? That's interesting.
No, I'm joking, but
I was going to say. I mean, who the we're going to get onto it later, aren't we? The post electronic sounds.
Yes.
Which is the title? Well, no, your latest CD, Agitations, Post Electronic Sounds.
Yes.
I was going to sort of say who is the sort of theorist, as it were, who came up, or did you all evolve the theory out of playing?
Oscillatorial Binage is like a carousel of ideas. So we've each got certain concepts that we pursue. So Ferry Bradley, for instance, has spearheaded the use of strings attached to sticks and pieces of wood. And on her residency, she actually took an axe and cut down a tree in Dubai somewhere and attached a string to it. So she stringifies wooden branches and things.
Okay.
And Chris did a piece, room tones piece, where you play the feedback tone of a room but steer it by an oscillator tone, which creates a concept piece of feedback and acoustics. And the post-electronic idea came about through each of us personalizing an electromagnetically resonated, force-filled device using found objects. And the basis of those devices came from things that I was experimenting with at the time, using found objects from bins.
Right.
And that was the time when we explicitly moved towards entirely found objects, using, like, really living up to our name, Oscillatorial Binage. I think almost every component, sound-making component, was scavenged from somewhere.
To be fair, we all have, as Dan was saying, there's a kind of carousel of ideas. We all have our own particular interests, and which come together within Oscillatorial Binage. But if I'm honest, you know, particularly in post-electronic idea, very much is something that comes from Dan's particular research that relates to his bin diving, relates to his interest in Victorian technologies, to do with the history of all sorts of forgotten histories of electronic music and things like that, which he's been developing very intensely and astutely.
But yeah. I would say that on the album, each of our individual voices are audible, because
that's true.
You do personalize post-electronic sound making does afford you an extremely deep degree of personalization for your setup. You can bring any object you like to the proceedings, whether it's a wooden frog, a Statue of Liberty, a cherished family heirloom, even, and all these become sound making modules in a post-electronic simulacra of a synthesizer, almost like an acoustic sound engine.
Is this a sort of genre now, or are you the only exponents of this?
It's interesting because we were talking, you know, what is post-electronics? Because, like, this is, as we mentioned just before, it's sort of like when I was thinking about this album afterwards, I was thinking, like, what is the time period where actually we would need post-electronics? Like, because we are so infused and sort of the digital is everywhere in all of our lives. So, like, actually, it's such a kind of
well, you'd
particular
have to
niche.
Imagine an environmental collapse at some point in the future, maybe, and that would be the post-electronic era, the Carrington.
The Carrington event. Yes, exactly.
So what the Carrington event? Well, that's a prompter. We have to we have to mention the Carrington event. What is this?
If you imagine, so there's this idea that various people have, in 1859, Richard Carrington witnessed a mass coronal mass ejection
from the sun.
From the sun, which is basically a massive electromagnetic storm that emanated from the sky, the sun, and at the same time there was actually. By pure coincidence, another guy called Richard Hodgson, who was also watching the sun at that time, and they both witnessed what it was essentially the largest of these solar flare events ever. And it, at the time, they say that certain telegraphs, early electronics, were electrics were blown up because of it. And so, and that you, and so they say that basically, if a similar event happened now, then all. Potentially, like all electronics and a lot of the infrastructure, digital infrastructure and electronic infrastructure we have would all be blown up, or would be
like
at least,
a fuse blowing, sort of.
Yeah,
thing.
Essentially. And
but, and would it be wiped or just stop functioning?
Well, that's a whole other thing. Is that actually it would create perhaps a kind of loss of our collective memory as well, because all the hard drives could be erased, and there's lots of interesting sides to it. And and so. So that was, I was imagining that actually that would be the only time when we would really truly reach a post-electronic time, because we'd have all the but the knowledge of the of what digital
of,
techniques
yeah,
have allowed
digital.
Us. And we'd have memories of the digital, but we wouldn't have the actual tools anymore.
Yeah.
So we'd have to make these sort of quasi...
things in the mould of a digital device.
Yeah.
But using twigs and... bits of wheelbarrow,
for example, and walks, what's it, so
what,
many
what
walks.
Is, what, but what's the difference between post-electronic and just acoustic?
Well, that's a good point, because that brings us back to the opening track you just played, which is a very unusual piece for Oslitor Binnage. That was Farry Bradley taking the role of Dr. Alcorn, the first ever female professional electric musician. That was a piece from 1887... called Clickety Click, and it featured an electromagnetic solenoid, and this is pre-electronic music, this is electrical music, and it's the technology being used there to generate the that's an electromagnetic solenoid, perhaps one of the few technologies that would survive a Carrington event.
I have to say, all I heard was the piano.
There was a Clickety Click in there.
Was there? Really? Oh, I'd have to play it again to hear it.
Yeah,
we won't do that now.
It was but,
so was this a deliberate attempt at a sort of rhythmic... he was creating a rhythm underneath the piano music?
It just happens to be the earliest...
Or was it a mistake?
No. That was intended. It was to showcase the wonders of electricity at a time when the music hall... there was a trend in the music hall for electro-musical entertainment. And this is part of my ongoing research in dredging up this lost history in electronic music, which is this pre-electronic music. And I think there's a kinship there between post-electronic music
but isn't
and
this,
pre...
Surely this is the birth of electronic music.
No, quite, because the valve hadn't been invented yet. The valve which afforded the movement of electrons.
Just the triggering of percussion,
isn't it? Yeah, this is just a coil triggering a mechanical device.
So is it electric or not?
It's electric, but not electronic. We come down to semantics here.
I don't think it's just semantics. I think it is, because it's clearly... Because interesting, it's actually something that now people are trying to do. You know, like Aphex Twin and people like that are all trying to do things where they trigger... like drum machines or things like that.
Well, on Instagram, you get so many people doing stuff with mechanical things now. The Powerland Academy is what's kind of semi-corporate. There seems to be a trend for moving towards mechanical activated devices.
Okay.
Although I would say that these people are probably using Arduinos, which are computer controlled. And
they wouldn't survive a Carrington
event. Yeah, that wouldn't survive a Carrington event. We're going right back to the basics. As performers.
It sounds a bit like the pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood in painting,
or Stuckism, even.
It's like you're harking back to some sort of age before
electronics? Sort of
Luddite-ism? Or do you see it as being incredibly progressive? Do you think you're beyond
It's accepting that the progress can't go on forever, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, but also
it's
you
not
have
necessarily
to,
harping back, but it's harping forward to the eventual collapse.
The actual music we play would not be acceptable in Victorian.
But I return to my question, what is the difference between what you're doing and acoustic music? If somebody's strumming a Spanish guitar, then they were doing that 500 years ago, and they'll be doing it in 500 years' time.
But they were strumming it with a human hand.
there's no electronics
involved.
Okay,
let me explain. In electronic music, you get this thing called an attack, decay, sustain, release envelope. And that is that is how you dictate the progress of an electronic tone. And for a long time in acoustic music, you'd have attack, like that's me hitting the table, that's attack. Yeah. Decay,
which brings up the subject of percussion, like, you know, drummers.
Yes, exactly. Hitting
bark with sticks. Okay. But that's not electronic, and that will probably continue after the apocalypse.
This is a timeless thing. This glass has got some decay. It doesn't just go. If I hold the glass like this, there's no decay. But if I do this.
Beautiful decay.
There's a decay. Yeah. And there's a release as well. The release is the decay.
Is this word decay entirely subjective? Is this your interpretation of
the
noise
is? No, this is the attack, decay, sustain, release envelope. This is an electronically accepted term for electronic music. The sustain, though, has historically been difficult to achieve. You can use bowing methods. You can keep brushing it. But technically, that's actually attack, really. What we use is electromagnetic force fields to provide the elusive sustain element in this analogy to create a form of post-electronic music using that force field as the sustain. And that gives the key to everything. It opens up a whole world. You can sustain tones indefinitely. You can make objects sing. And you can even bring objects together and make them interact and graze together.
An alternative to electronic
You could say, in a sense, it's an alternative to ambient. It's making ambient drone music after, with techniques before it was even thought of.
Yeah,
but it's something else.
But are you trying to replicate electronic music without electronics?
Originally, that's the intention, but we discover that something else happens. It's not just ambience. There's unpremeditated things that take place, unforeseen events. Sometimes a ball or a piece of paper might migrate somewhere across the wok that you're resonating, and a saucepan might graze against the edge and create a rhythm. And you get a phenomena that's called entrainment. And entrainment is where, or emergence, it's where two systems of vibration interact and throttle each other slightly, and you build up this very complex system of vibration from what is essentially simple
which would be a nice segue into your ideas of miraculous agitation.
Yes, miraculous agitations is miraculous agitation. I have to be careful because it's been taken up by I was doing this separate project called Radionics Radio, and they think I'm going to make a I have to be a bit hard-headed about the terms I use to describe it, because I think I'm a miracle worker sometimes.
Essentially, in my understanding of it, is the idea that certain sounds can emerge from a number of different objects, particularly in vibration with each other, and a sound can emerge that you couldn't have foreseen, or you couldn't have with intention made happen.
It
takes you by surprise. It's kind of like an extension of improvisation. You could say it's an extension of improvisation onto objects in a vibrating system on their own.
That's perfect.
Without the humans getting involved.
Yes, that's perfect.
Without
that
humans? Well, how could it be without humans?
You have to trigger it with the humans.
It takes on a life of its own.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Right.
It's kind of emergent systems.
Right. So it's a music.
In a vibrating wok.
So you set something up and then it can go off in a direction that is unpredictable?
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. Unstable.
Unstable. And that's so when you perform, are you performing a preconceived piece that you know with a score, or are you literally just starting from scratch and thinking, well, we don't know what's going to happen for the next?
There's a loose score in terms of the objects we choose and the tones that we begin with, but it can go anywhere after that. After the first 2 minutes, you're in territory where anything can happen.
Right.
And it even has a subjective effect. I think sometimes when we were recording in France, we're using a lot of solar-powered amps to generate these force fields. And the effect, it can be quite hallucinatory. You almost get into a meditative state of mind and something emerges from the mist of this tone. You get rhythm appearing and sometimes you get melodic flourishes and progressions.
Do you think is it purer than electronic sound?
I wouldn't want to define anything as pure or less pure.
I was listening to the CD last night and it did. I mean, I'm just wondering, does it have, to the untrained ear, would somebody listening to it think there are no electronics involved here? I can hear that this is just some other kind of other kind of sound being created.
There's moments where someone might mistakenly assume this is electronic sound because of its complexity. But then at other points, suddenly you hear a room noise or a kind of acoustic noise, which suddenly brings you back into the room.
And
you
think, dog barking.
Sometimes. Or a fly landing on a microphone.
Right. If you took it to its ultimate, you know, if you take it to the extreme, would you prefer that it wasn't played electronically at all? So in other words, you wouldn't even have a CD.
So how would we play it?
It'd just be a live performance,
wouldn't it? Romantically assume, because it came out on CD on Sub Rosa. It's coming out this month, and it's available from forcedexposure.com at the moment, and it'll be on Boomcat soon as well. And we kind of romantically imagined that the CD might be the last ever CD ever produced, because it seems that nobody has CD players anymore. But it's not, obviously not.
But it could be on vinyl or cassette or a file. Digital, it could be on Spotify or whatever.
Or download as well.
But at its purest form, would you rather that it wasn't on any of those things? Because it would be.
To be fair, there is a certain level of post production that's gone into the album, so it's not, they're not pure.
We haven't interfered with the sound too much. We haven't actually interfered with the texture of the sound. We haven't done any EQing or reverb or anything like that. Even the stereo has been left exactly as it is, as recorded. So there's very little interference with the tone. But the actual cutting of the tracks into the... This bit sounds interesting, and that's a track.
And there were many microphones recording it at the time, so there was a certain level of choice.
Yeah, there are about 20 different sounds.
20 different microphones,
and piezoelectric.
Mm. Because the thing with this, so the whole setup of all these piles of woks and springs and et cetera, is that obviously at different points within it, there are different sounds. And so it's a kind of, if you imagine like a table, I'm trying to, for people to be able to picture what it is. Yeah. Is it, because I think when you see it, you really... hits you, you understand it, but it's like you've got imagine a massive table. It's just piled full of all sorts of springs, woks, lamppost, doors, various other kind of metal objects, all in vibration with each other, and
going through the table that we're
and
on
going
as
through
well.
The table as well, and so. You're creating a kind of chaotic system,
right?
On a table.
Obviously, there is a history of improvised performance and music, but you're saying that those before you came along, people would have used laptops and electronic stuff as well, and you're trying to purge
Be careful here. We're not proclaiming to have invented anything, because this thing recently, I don't know if you saw on Twitter, William Close, it claims to have invented a long string instrument, the Earth Harp, and everyone's up in arms because everyone knows that Ellen Fullman is the long string instrument inventor, and her Earth Harp is in Just Intonation, which is I think a much more superior.
I sense a degree of sidestepping my questions. I've posed about three questions.
I have looked into the lineage.
You've created a sort of smokescreen in each case.
Well, I'm going in a kind of circumnavigating.
I know you are.
I will eventually come back to the question if I'm not interrupted with another question.
Oh, well. I see. Okay. Well, I'm waiting for the answer for the first one.
There's a Japanese performer. He's actually Korean, sorry. Akio Suzuki, who in the 60s invented an instrument called the analapos, which is basically like a tin cans and string telephone with a spring.
Oh, yeah.
And the word analapos is a combination of analog and postmodern. And it was his vision of this instrument having electronic qualities, the postmodern element, but also the analog real world quality. And that was in the 60s.
Ah,
and
okay.
Around that time as well, you did have people like Terence Dwyer, who were writing textbooks for schools on how to make electronic music. But he recognized, Terence Dwyer, that many schools couldn't afford synthesizers. So his book was full of these images of toilet rolls and people putting their hands over crisp packets to generate analogies for low pass filters and to generate like a kazoo for a square wave.
Yeah.
And so he was actually doing a kind of post electronic guide for schools that couldn't afford synthesizers.
Right.
But yours
is a sort of philosophical. I mean, you've got a definite sort of agenda, haven't you? It sounds like you. I mean,
I wouldn't say it's. I mean, that's the thing. I think part of the reason why he was sort of seemed to be sidestepping your question was that it was just. It's not really It's not a thing about wanting to get away from electronics, truly, or it's just in a way, it's a kind of creative constraint. Hmm. It's like you set up a sort of space which has certain limits, and then within that limit, those limits of you try and make some beautiful sounds or some great sounds.
Yeah. Should we play something, do you think, to give people an idea of what you're about?
We have got an exclusive for you. Track three on that
track three
is an unreleased experiment of our rehearsal.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was an unreleased post-electronic experiment by Oscillatorial Binage. Two members of Binage are with me today, Toby Clarkson and Dan Wilson. Fari Bradley and Chris Weaver can't be with us. So perhaps you could tell me a bit about what's going on in that track, Dan, or
that,
Toby.
That was an experiment with force fields resonating found objects. I can't remember the exact setup we used, but I think on that occasion we were using a lot of springs, springs being subjected to various systems of feedback.
If I remember correctly, there was quite a lot of oven grills involved.
Oh, yes, there were oven grills and things wedged at certain points as well. You can bring out certain harmonics. One of the things about post-electronic music is that you remember that synthesizers do have graduated controls. Synthesizers are mathematical instruments, and the dials do have levels on them written on, decibel levels and degrees. And we find that things like grills and springs can be segmented visually, and you can pick out certain nodal points, harmonic points, which if you touch, bring out the harmonic. Mm. And then you can produce forms of additive synthesis, I suppose, but in a very acoustic way. And another thing that post-electronic apparatuses allow you to do, which is very submerged in electronic devices, is you can bring out subharmonics very, very easily. A lot of the rattles and clunks and buzzes that you heard there are subharmonics, which are tones that ride the main train of vibration as a bounce, so they miss every. Imagine my hand waving, and there's a ping pong ball on it, and the ping pong ball is periodically jumping up, then recolliding, then jumping up and recolliding. That's a subharmonic. That rhythm is a multiple lower than the frequency that my hand is fluctuating at. Have I made it overcomplicated? I could see you zoning out.
It's good to have lots of layers of complexity, and in the song, there's lots of depth to those sounds.
Yeah,
and I think you can engage in it on lots of different levels.
You've had a good analogy, like in photography, where digital photography has a limit to the depth,
the grain of it, essentially, because you get to the grain of the pixel. I mean, it's a loose analogy, but listening to that now, I was just thinking that when you zoom in on a digital photograph, then you reach a sort of depth level limit when you come to the pixels. Mm. But on a chemically processed analog photograph, then you can sort of zoom into the texture of the chemical processing sort of almost infinitely.
And well, you get granularity.
Granularity, because it's actually made from matter, you know.
Right.
And so it's similar with these tracks, especially listening to that. This has got so much layers, I think beautiful layers of
quite fluid as well.
Fluid and clickety and just all sorts of little grainy sounds.
But
is
that compromised once it is channeled through an electronic system?
Yes. Yes, that's one of the things. We are a live group.
So once it's on a CD, for example, or a vinyl, if one did what Toby describes, that thing of going in and in and in and in further and further, you would sooner or later come across the electronic, whatever you call it, fingerprint.
Yes, that's true. And possibly less so on vinyl because of the format is, I suppose.
Wouldn't vinyl be the equivalent of a chemical analog?
It depends how it's mastered.
But would you see that as a failing? Is it compromised by the process?
The final process. Well, I think that's the necessary evil to present the idea. To be able to make post-electronic music, if we were just a live band,
isn't that the logical conclusion? Is to only be a live band, and almost—it's like saying to people, saying turn off your phones.
There's a problem,
you know,
because
the size of our
apparatuses is inhibiting. It's like an albatross.
That's problem number one. We have a whole list of problems. Number two is the fact that we're searching out, miraculous agitations through improvisation.
Ah,
so
good point.
Obviously, you can't trust that to happen. If it happens so rarely that almost, say we did 10 gigs, we'd probably get a miraculous agitation if we're lucky once.
Yeah.
So basically almost any...
So it's miraculous.
90% of the time, our gigs will be failures.
It's miraculous.
We shouldn't say this.
I'm exaggerating.
Okay.
We leave audiences.
So the miraculous agitation is like a happy accident then?
It's like a lottery. You know, it's like a lottery. You may turn up to a gig and get something grand.
It's like real life, I suppose. You go somewhere hoping to meet interesting people, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It depends on the temperaments of the people, the weather, the architecture, all kinds of variables.
The humidity is definitely a factor.
I mean, I'm looking at the cover of the CD now. I'm holding this new CD, which has come out on Sub Rosa.
We haven't played any tracks yet.
Called Agitations, Post-Electronic Sounds by Oscillatorial Binage. And I did notice in the tiny small print somewhere or other in this thing, that is it mastered by Gabriel Severin?
Yeah, that was actually just levelling. So he's just levelling the tracks.
It's just I've got two or three of his CDs, and they're very interesting.
Really?
He's a really interesting musician, composer himself. But he's here he is in the sort of small... Anyway, the images on here do show... I mean, for instance, here there is a wire.
That's a coil. That's one of the electromagnetic force field generators.
Here?
These are classed as... These are non-electronic. These are electric components. Yes. That's why we played clickety-click at the start, because pre-electronic music has a kinship with post-electronic music in that the use of electromagnetism or even electrostatics is permissible. It's an allowed...
You see, permissible.
Feature.
You see, we now come to this agenda. It is as though you're kind of. It's like a fundamentalist kind of.
It's permissible in the event of a Carrington event. It's not us. It's not us imposing this.
Okay.
We're imagining this Carrington event.
We're very far from purists. I mean, it's just.
That is the ultimate extremist position. It's almost like
we're
saying
fundamentally against purists.
That's such a giveaway. you've revealed yourself as fanatics.
Junk fanatics.
Congregating
around a table of bin-dived metal.
Yeah, sounds dangerous now, I must admit.
Well, actually, whenever we transport it, we're worried about being searched a terrorist.
Well,
because,
we do.
Because they are, because they're so...
One of the things I'd love to do is use explosives more often.
Don't say that.
Sorry, I've written this piece with a wire on the history of explosives in music, but we can't. Yeah, we're not
too late, mate. Okay. I can hear that, yeah. Okay, so should we play one track from here?
Let's play Woktones, because that gives an idea of how it sounds without...
I thought that was quite a long one. I could be advised. I mean, what about Wokfinger Fanfare?
Well, I think Woktones is the elemental one. That's the very basic force field experiment with no objects inside the woks.
So do you want to explain a little bit also what we do with... I mean, the woks just aren't... They're resonating, but we also have microphones.
We could talk over it, maybe.
Well, let's let it play for a bit.
Maybe. All right. So I'm fading it down slightly. We'll leave it playing in the background. This is, what's this? This is Woktones.
Yes.
And is that because it's, is this purely wok?
Pure wok.
Pure wok.
Unadulterated.
So do you each play a wok?
Yes, I think so. There's an image, actually, of the actual recording process inside the CD.
Right.
And we have each, yes, we each have a wok.
Oh, yes, I can see there's a sort of aerial view looking down on the four performers.
Yeah. We're all walking away.
Walk, yes, I'm going to resist any more.
Yeah, there were lots,
any more
lots
sort
of puns when we
puns
were doing
about
the
walking. Yes.
There was actually two woks connected by a spring, and we called it a bridge over double walkers.
Right.
Bridge over doubled walkers.
Walk and roll. Lots of
exactly.
Things,
yeah. The, like, the new wok. Yeah.
So, walk on by.
Yeah. And we won't add an E to it. That would cause trouble, wouldn't it?
So yeah, so this is this. If you're Dan was talking about the sort of theatre of all the objects vibrating together and interacting and nudging each other and everything. And so if that, those objects were all in the theatre play, then this would be the stage,
right.
Essentially.
Oh, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
So this is pure stage with nothing on, in it or on it. So the only found object here is the wok itself.
Right.
And Dan has a very extensive collection of woks. Found woks.
Yep.
Right.
I'm beginning to stagger them now, so build these wok assemblies where one wok is inside the other, and it's like a flower almost, like a very grubby flower, metallic flower,
yeah.
Of one wok going inside the other with all the coils resonating them inside.
Could there be a limit? Could you have like sort of... you know, 20 or 30 woks, one above the
other? You'd get to a point
other?
Where it's no longer a wok. There'd be a cup inside or a thimble eventually.
Oh, it has to get smaller.
Yeah, yeah, they have to... Yeah.
Oh, you're imagining a sort of Russian doll of woks?
Yeah,
that would be
beautiful. I have got a few of those. It's an easy way to store them as well.
But would you, in that case, would you get to a point where you might want to design, instead of it being a found wok, you could design an instrument where you start with a huge wok shape and you make them gradually smaller, so it's like a pyramid of woks that you've actually made and designed and made, and that would be would that be a sort of like a new instrument?
That would be brilliant, and we'd love to do that. But the whole
can I patent that?
The whole premise of the album is that how do you make music when you've got no funds?
Ah,
so we're working with found objects, and we are always await installations and commissions. Actually, we've done quite a few different installations and commissions, but the premise of the album is really an apocalyptic scenario, post-electronic music in the wake of some kind of collapse, an imagining of how you would make music in the wreckage of what's left behind.
Right.
So,
but still with the memories of what had existed before.
Yes, yeah. Or the envy, even, of what existed before.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you looking forward to this situation?
No.
I mean, I'm ambivalent towards it.
Actually, I'm basing my whole... I'm not going to get a pension when I'm old, so I'm basing my whole life on environmental collapse.
So actually, Dan is the first person... When that happens, is the first person I will be calling, because he has so much experience of surviving in such conditions. But
I don't think anyone would want a wok resonator. They want a plumber, someone
exactly,
that can make a wicker basket. I can make a wicker basket.
But people still need to be entertained in the...
But it's interesting that the wok is also an instrument for cooking. I mean, you could...
During the process, do you remember the gardener came in and actually chucked us all a plum to put in the wok? He actually said, "I see you're cooking." He chucked in these...
That's true.
But I played a snatch last week of something by... You might have heard of him, someone called John Lifton. He did something called green music in the 70s, which was sort of to do with plants and gathering the sounds of plants. He thought that that plants created...
How did he record the sounds of plants?
No idea. I don't
did
know.
He
it was
connect
a very short
circuits
piece.
Directly to the plants?
I'm not sure. It sounds a little bit like... I remember Clive Graham talking about what Michael Prime is doing, I think, in Ireland. Isn't he doing something on these, along these lines with the sounds of plants?
But, well, we have the sounds of leaves.
Abscission, which is a term used for the falling of leaves, I think. Mm-hmm. Abscission, that was Chris's track title. Abscission is woks. It's wok tones, but with leaves.
Right.
So if you imagine a wok full of dead leaves... And then the very subtle vibrationary possibilities of all those leaves in one place.
Well, so this track,
rubbing,
I think,
up against each other.
This is Abscission 2. So, I mean, just to repeat one of my earlier questions, which sort of got sort of somewhat sidelined, shall we say? The bit about it being a genre, are you alone in this activity, or are there others who are already sort of pursuing the same?
It depends how you define the boundaries. I mean, there's certainly other people doing acoustic-based things, which, like acoustic techno or things like that. You know,
Graham Dunning's mechanical techno, which is, use a record player, and it rotates and triggers all these little other electronic devices. But it is an electronic process, but it's it's taking the concept of sequencing and making it very, very visible. So you can see this massive rotating disc, which is piled up and things. And so he's doing that.
Right.
And I mentioned Akio Suzuki, who as far back as the 60s has merged analog and postmodern in his Analapos.
A name that comes to mind, which might be a complete irrelevance, you might say, no, it's nothing to do with that, is Conlon Nancarrow,
Would
you sort of play a piano?
You can go right back. I mean, just like with the clickety click that we started with, it's not something that just necessarily emerges from electronic music culture, this post-electronic idea. It's something that's always shadowed electronic music, and often happened quite independently. This ideal of being able to control the tone of a tone, if that makes sense. So there are all kinds of eccentric piano modification patents from the Victorian era, where you could use a big dial, for instance, to open and close the back of the piano to change the volume, and also play a piano type things, pushing a piano to its limits, just like Conlon Nancarrow was doing, trying to make the piano perform impossible feats.
Well, exactly. When you just listen to it, it sounds impossible because it's so fast, doesn't it? So you realise nobody could actually play the piano that quickly.
So, but he wasn't necessarily using the control mechanism, I suppose. The player piano control is a form of, I don't know, post-electronic inputting, I suppose. Yeah. But it's obviously not, it was contemporary with electronic, or even before it slightly. When was he active? 1950s?
He did a thing at Islington probably 20, 25 years ago, but of course it wasn't performed on a player piano. It's a bit like your situation where I think it was played through speakers and so on. You know what I mean? So it had to be performed electrically or electronically. I don't know. He wasn't
pre-recorded.
They didn't actually yet.
Okay.
But he was there, and that was, I must be 20 years ago at least. But anyway, that's probably a bit of a side. Toby, you are really, you're a filmmaker.
I'm a filmmaker and editor, usually. And as it happens, so there's lots of intertwining. As Dan was saying, we're on a kind of carousel, all of us in the group. Yeah. We all have different particular interests and different things we bring to it and ideas and such. And I, through my interests in sound and in playing in Oscar Binage and knowing Dan and various other things, I actually, a few years back, I made a film called Little Tsunamis that has Dan in it.
Right.
It took me many years to get access to his home and his parents' home, particularly.
You've been in Dan's home?
I have.
This is a privilege indeed.
I have documentary evidence of it. You can see it in Little Tsunamis, the film. And essentially, it's a film about listening.
I've often wondered if the parents sort of in the next room hearing these sounds. coming through the wall, you know, like, how is it?
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of Dan's. He's sort of taken over a lot of the house.
There's outhouses.
Oh, you mean the parents are outside?
I mean, the parents are sort of relegated to a corner, and everything else is Dan's collection.
They've got their own. I'm exaggerating. They've got their own stuff.
No, his parents are very lovely and very accommodating. And
okay,
Well, they're kind of resigned to my fate. Actually, I think they're
to their fate. I would think. we shouldn't be too jocular here. It is a serious pursuit.
It is a very serious pursuit. I mean, but I think also, you know, I think that's also something where we all get on in Ostertrombridge. We take it very seriously, but also there's always going to be a sort of absurdist side to this kind of work.
It's interesting you should say
that, because you can laugh about
Zaf
as well.
Mann, who does the In Memory of John Peel show in America, mentioned he thought post-electronic music was a bit of a gaffe, a joke. He didn't realise how serious the album was. He thought
who said that? Right?
Zafod Mann. He presents a podcast called the In Memory of John Peel show.
Oh, really?
And it was interesting that he thought it was the album was a gag.
I don't see it as a problem to see it as one aspect like that. It's very serious. It's actually very serious, like underneath that. So
it's fun as well.
It's fun as well. But it's rhythms, but I mean, it's seriously, you know, we've taken it very seriously when we made the album and things. And so it's, but there's also, I think I love improvised music, but there's always an element of ridiculousness to it as well. And I think you have to kind of appreciate that and not reject that. Like, that's part of it. But it's.
But Musique Concrète was entirely serious, wasn't it?
I say it depends what kind
Pierre
of objects
Schaefer
you're playing with.
People like that. I mean, that was a sort of, that was a serious kind of research, wasn't it?
It fell into different hands and was I think it's only serious because it was done in an academic setting. We know Pierre Schaefer from the French school, which was in a rival at the time with the German school, which is more serialism focused. Yeah. And I think that's where the seriousness comes from. When you're dealing with non-academic, I think the definitions are much looser.
Do you think that's a bit of an English thing? It's more inclined to acknowledge the absurdity of it?
I don't think so.
I do think there's a little bit of that. There's a kind of self-depreciating Englishness, English humour, which this gets, perhaps we pass on it into in a certain sense because we are English.
Right. Well, remember, it was the French guy that chucked in the plums into the wok.
Yeah, but I don't think he meant. I think he was serious.
Exactly. He would have taken it seriously, whereas you would have seen the humour in it. Yeah, that's right. But that could be a strength, couldn't it?
Yeah, I think Akio Suzuki as well. He's an absurdist too. He grew up in Japan, so there's. I don't think it's necessarily.
This kind of harks back to the kind of idea of purist or not. I think you can have both of those things at the same time. You can take something very seriously and also see the absurdity of it as well.
So. We could play. I will. One of my favourite pieces on this is Wok Finger on Fanfare, which is quite a short piece. We could play a bit of that now. Yeah. Is it true that the whole pace of the thing is quite slow throughout?
Meditative.
The whole. So, okay, just to give it one more. Where this is available on. This is on Sub Rosa, the Sub Rosa label.
It's available as download or a CD. The CD includes a booklet which gives a history, shows some Victorian patents, and then aligns them with what we're doing, and then progresses that and talks about the post-electronic modus operandi. It shows you the hallucinatory potential of some of the sounds.
So this is called the CD is called Agitations, Post-Electronic Sounds by Oscillatorial Binage.
Available on eBay, Amazon soon.
Okay.
Boomcat, Forced Exposure, Juno.
We'll play, I like this track, Wok Finger on Fanfare, which is a fairly shortish track. We could sort of talk over the top of it or not.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that's Walk Finger on Fanfare from Agitations Post-Electronic Sounds by Oscillatorial Binage. And today's guests have been Toby Clarkson and Daniel R. Wilson, two members of the quartet. You're not playing anywhere now until November, it seems. Hamburg.
Possibly. A festival. We can't really say anything about that yet because it's not been confirmed. But it's on the cards. Right. There's possibly another gig coming up in the summer, actually. But you can follow us on Twitter at Oscillatorial. And just keep updated on there because we do lots of guerrilla actions as well.
Do you? Well, that's interesting. I mean,
not necessarily all four of us. Sometimes.
Buy the album.
Buy the album. Buy the album.
Buy the album.
Yes. Subliminal sales pitch there from Toby.
It is actually a beautiful album.
So. Yeah. Yeah, and it's on Sub Rosa, which is a nice venue for it as well.
You had to record it. Where did you record it, actually?
Ah, well.
That's a very good point, because it was recorded in France. Plenty of sunlight. We're using some kind of solar-powered equipment as well, mostly, and to keep... but then, this is the bit that could put us to shame.
Oh.
It just happened that during the recording, Chris and Farry had a residency in Dubai. I don't know how they got there, their carbon footprint was. because we are environmentally focused group, but it just happened they were in Dubai. So they recorded some there. So we gave them sounds to feed through oil barrels, fittingly.
Okay.
And the oil barrels became the outlets for some of the recordings we'd made in France. Right. So the last track, Mechanized Mirage, is recorded in Dubai by Chris and Fari.
Right. And also some of it was recorded in Mount Pleasant in Clapton.
In Clapton, yeah, with modified Intona Remori, as used by Dr. Ed Baxter in the 2014 reconstruction of The Art of Noises, the futurist performance.
Well, so this is we can play out with Mechanized Mirage.
Yes, the sound of oil barrels.
Feel free to talk over the top of it if you want to. So is the studio sort of the one you mentioned in France, is that some sort of environmentally friendly studio, solar-powered or something?
It's on the grid.
It was in a self-sufficient farm, essentially. Yes. We were only eating during the... Actually, I hadn't thought of that. It was during the whole making of it. We were only living on vegetables picked from their farm as well.
Yeah. And we were washing our hands with not washing up liquid, but homemade washing up liquid from this strange oiliness.
Yes, and that wasn't something we tried to do to be pure. Right. We just sort of... That's just what happened because we happened to
be... So how did you arrive at this studio? I mean, how did you pick the studio?
Chris and Fari just happened to be staying there, and we thought we'd kill multiple birds with one stone and go there with them and record a piece. It's Bob and Maggie's studio, Bob Drake and Maggie Thomas.
And they were great. And their farm is lovely down in the south of France.
Right.
So. In the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the name of it?
Cal de Vol, or the Border Bass Studio.
Border what?
The Border Bass Studio.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you both very much for coming in. We'll play out with Mechanized Mirage.
Thank you.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.